Welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. Today we'll look at a number of subjects in the news, and we'll begin in a moment and talk about the prospect or the portent of the use of chemical weapons in the forthcoming war in Iraq. And we'll be talking with Ray Zelinskas, who is the director of the Chemical and Biological Weapons Nonproliferation Program at the Monterey Institute. And Ray Zelinskas was a former inspector with UNSCOM. And we'll talk about Iraq's previous use of chemical weapons, what they possibly have in their inventory and what they may use, and more importantly, how the United States military is prepared to defend themselves or protect the troops against these weapons of mass destruction. And we'll look into the whole nature of how what would happen if soldiers came under attack. And, of course, in this build-up to this war, there's been scant discussion on the part of the Bush administration about things that may go wrong. And former senator, the head of the Senate Select Intelligence Committee on Bob Graham, forced the administration to allow the CIA to release reports indicating that Saddam Hussein, once he is targeted, which he and he's obviously the object of regime change, that he is likely to use these weapons in the sense use them or lose them. So we'll look into what may happen and how one defends how you defend troops against chemical weapons. We'll also talk with Bruce Lincoln, who is a professor of the history of religion at the University of Chicago. He has a book, Holy Terrors, Thinking About Religion After 9/11. And we'll be talking to him about President Bush's faith-based foreign policy and the extent to which theological language is creeping into most of the president's speeches and in the press conference that was conducted last Friday, and get a sense of how much Jesus is looking over the president's shoulder. And in the last segment, we'll talk in studio with John Sackett Young, who is a producer of a film that's coming out tonight, Sunday night, on FX, The Pentagon Papers. We'll be talking to him and possibly also to the subject of the film, Daniel Ellsberg, who is traveling back east and is going to try and connect by cell phone. And we'll also be joined by Conrad Kellen, who was a senior analyst at RAND. The RAND Corporation is where the Pentagon Papers were purloined, and the movie is set here in Santa Monica and in Washington, D.C. So we'll be talking to a former senior analyst at RAND, who was also the secretary to Thomas Mann, and he will give us a sense of the atmosphere at RAND at the time of the Pentagon Papers, where there was, in fact, even within the RAND Corporation itself, a anti-war movement, if you will. There was a petition that was circulated by Conrad Kellen and others. So we'll get a sense of the history. And, of course, there is echoes of the present in the Pentagon Papers film, given that there is an anti-war movement developing, in this case, before there's a war, as opposed to during the Vietnam War, where the anti-war movement developed over several years after the war began. I'm now speaking with Ray Zelinskas, who is the director of the Chemical and Biological Weapons Nonproliferation Program at the Monterey Institute, and you also were a former inspector with UNSCOM, and you're very familiar with chemical weapons. And do you accept the notion that Senator Graham and others have clearly feel that it's important for the American public, or particularly the soldiers that are about to go to war in Iraq, to understand that chemical weapons are going to be used? Now, I understand the United States military has made preparations. Raymond, what's your sense of how well prepared the U.S. military is?
I think they're pretty well prepared. The lesson from past uses of chemical weapons in World War One and against the Ethiopians and then against the use of them by the Iraqis against Iranians and the Kurdish, is that if the receivers are well prepared, they usually don't suffer. It's the unprepared. They work best when they're used against unprepared people, whether by surprise or because they don't have the equipment. But once the people that are recipients of these weapons become prepared and learn how to deal with the situation, then they lose their effectiveness. And I do think that their joint forces, their coalition forces, are well prepared.
And what about this term that the military uses, area denial? In other words, if you dump this toxic stuff over an area, you basically can't go there.
That's what the Iraqis did against the Iranians, because the Iranians had such overwhelming human resources compared to the Iraqis. They used the chemical weapons, especially mustard gas, to essentially saturate areas where they didn't want anybody to go through. And that puts a tremendous logistic burden on the attacker who wants to go through this. And in that way, it helps dug-in force to protect their own positions.
And I understand that and when you were an inspector in Iraq under the ANSCOM regime, as opposed to the new incarnation, UNMAVIC, back in the early 90s, there is a considerable inventory of chemical weapons that's unaccounted for. How much of the most dangerous one, VX, are the Iraqis supposed to have?
They declared that they made 3.9 tons of it, which is really a significant quantity. But on the other hand, they also said they destroyed it unilaterally, in other words, without UNSCOM being part of that. And they also said that their VX they made was very ineffective. It was really experimental stuff that never really worked out. Now, of course, we don't know any of that stuff because, as I said, the VX they made was destroyed without UNSCOM inspectors being there. And the sampling has been done of the ground where this VX was supposed to have been dumped has been unrevealing. So that's one of the issues that's still up for clarification. Another one is that there's something like between 5,000 and 6,000 pieces of artillery and bombs that's supposed to be left over from the Iran war, and that's still like unaccounted for also.
And what did those warheads contain?
Mostly mustard. Maybe some contain sarin, which is another nerve agent that's about 10 times weaker than VX, but still a very significant quantity of chemical weapons.
And VX it has the consistency of vegetable oil, doesn't it?
That's right. It's dispersed as small droplets. Mm-hmm. VX is very important because it actually penetrates through skin, unlike sarin. So that makes it possible, makes it imperative for the people who are defending themselves to have full suits in addition to their gas masks.
And one droplet is sufficient to kill you, I understand.
One drop the size of a pinhead.
Uh-huh. So let's put ourselves in the position of the young American soldiers going into Iraq. If Saddam uses, let's say he does have VX and uses it, there would be some kind of warning. How would the warning manifest itself? To know that, because obviously if the stuff is coming down on you before you put your suit on, it's all over. So you've obviously got to have time to put those cumbersome rubber suits on. That takes some time in itself, doesn't it?
Yes. Well, it's difficult to know exactly how they're going to use it. Chemical weapons usually are not very effective in a situation where you have very mobile warfare. So in other words, if you have the coalition forces moving very quickly across the ground, they're not going to be really a good target for chemical weapons, except, like I said before, for area denial. But the most likely first sign of a chemical weapon being used is that the artillery shells are coming over have a different sound, because the burster charge has to be quite a bit less than with normal, so you get much more subdued popping of the artillery shell. So that could be one. But, of course, that could be camouflaged by other artillery shells that are, say, going off normally.
Mm-hmm.
Another possibility is that you can have a low-flying plane flying upwind from the attacking forces. However, I don't think that's likely because the coalition forces are going to have 100% air superiority.
What about smaller drones, remote-controlled drones?
Yes, the Iraqis do have them, and they're slow-moving, and they probably can be picked up pretty well by defenses, air defenses. However, yes, that is definitely a possibility. So that would be another sign if there's a slow-flying unmanned vehicle coming across it, or especially if it's upwind, then that would be a clear indication that something suspicious is going to happen.
And also, don't they have the nerve agents in the 122-millimeter rocket barrage, you know, like the old Stalin organs?
Yeah, that's a question, because those things were really destroyed under UNSCOM in 1993, 1994. So the question is, were they able to hide any? Those were very, very unstable munitions. They were leaking, and they were fairly ineffective. So, they could have them, but I don't think that they're really a tactical problem because they were just not good enough.
So if the warning comes, either there's a drone or the artillery comes over and has a different sound, so the soldiers rush to put on their chemical suits. These are sort of fairly, well, obviously impermeable. They're kind of rubberized. They have to put on a gas mask as well. They have to cover every part of their body, right?
Right, but first you have to remember that we have actually pretty effective detectors in the chemical area, unlike the biological, where we don't have any detectors worth anything as far as real time. So there are both what they call standoff detectors. In other words, detectors that can pick up a cloud coming at you. And then there's point detectors, usually stuff that their soldiers have on them or are in a mobile laboratory. So these are, in the chemical area, are fairly well advanced and probably be the first thing that would go off if there was to be a chemical attack. But even if there was this indications and of the low-flying drone or the odd-sounding artillery shells, the sign would go out right away for everybody to become suited up. And the suits that the coalition forces have now are actually fairly comfortable. Unlike the old ones that were made out of rubber and didn't breathe, these are much lighter. They have a lining of activated charcoal, which makes it them more effective, and you can actually function even in heat with these things.
So you've obviously got to put them on in a hurry. Now, I understand there's a problem with the suits that the coalition have in their inventory. I believe that there were 800,000 supplied to the Pentagon, 300,000 of which were defective, made by a crooked contractor, who was in jail, I believe. The CEO and the other officers in the company were tried and convicted and put in jail. But I understand that the Pentagon mixed the defective suits in with the rest of them. So, 300,000 out of 800,000 are not up to snuff. So, I mean, how much of do the soldiers have reassurance that aren't you sort of playing roulette here with your chem suits?
Well, the primary suits, the ones that they have initially, are all of a new generation. So those things are supposed to be very good and very effective. The problem then would become if there were to be several chemical attacks, because the first generation suit, the ones that are on the front line right now, have to be changed within 24 hours of a chemical attack. So then you have to go to the secondary suits, and they include these defective suits. But, you know, they still offer a lot of protection, even the poor ones. We're talking about, it's true that a little pinprick or a little pinhead-sized droplet or VX would affect you. But most likely the chemical agents that the Iraqis would have a lot of would be mustard. And that is not as powerful, nearly as powerful as VX. So, yes, it's not a very good situation to have these defective suits there, but they still are much, much better than nothing.
So let's just go with the frontline soldiers and the front with the frontline suits, the ones at work. They get doused with this stuff. They can't get out of their suits. They have to be decontaminated before they can get out of their suits.
That's right.
And how does that? How do you have a logistical train to decontaminate you in the desert? Where don't you? Doesn't this require a lot of water and a lot of enclosed vehicles?
That's true, and we don't know, or at least I don't know, what the coalition forces have done about that. I know that theoretically what you have are, you have personnel decontamination devices and you have equipment decontamination devices. So with the personnel, it looks like big showers, and what comes out of them is mostly water, even though there are some neutralizing chemicals in put into that water. So the people that get contaminated walk through these kind of shower-like structures, and then when they come out on the other one, they're dried off and tested to see if they have really been decontaminated, and then they can get out of their suits. So yes, it does take a lot of water, it takes a lot of effort, and also you kind of have to worry to what happens with the water that you use, because that's to that's contaminated with toxic substances. As far as equipment, if for example, if a tank, an Abrams tank, becomes contaminated with a chemical, that has to go through like a huge car wash. Well, it's not really that. What you have is a bunch of fire hoses coming at the truck from different directions, again with a decontamination solution. And again, you have to worry about the what you do with the waste.
Well, first of all, I wonder where you get the water from and where all this equipment is and how quickly it can get to the front. If it's the size of, Abrams tank is much, much bigger than a normal vehicle, so it's a big structure, presumably.
Sure. Yes. I don't think that the whole front line is going to be contaminated. One, what you're going to have are attacks in certain points, so you're not going to have 250,000 people all at once being, contaminated with chemical fluid. It would probably be like maybe there's a company or even a battalion here and there that are going to be affected. We're talking about maybe, 100 to at the most 1,000 people that are going to be affected.
Well, that's a best case scenario, clearly.
Well, that's probably more likely than everybody getting it. The Iraqi is just not going to have the logistical ability to do that. So getting back to the water problem, yes, you would initially you would have to have these big tanker trucks full of water that follows the advancing forces. But I can imagine that there are two sizable rivers that were along which the population of Iraq is pretty well grouped. That's the Tigris and Euphrates. And you could take water from these rivers. They're also, funny enough, you can see it on the maps. Certain times of the year, there are rather large lakes in the central and the southern parts of Iraq that, depending on how much rain and so on there have been, can also be used, even though the water in those lakes are pretty well brackish or rancid. For decontamination purposes, that would work perfectly well. So there are some ways you can get water when you're in Iraq.
But as you pointed out, Ray Zelinskis, that when the soldiers who've been exposed are scrubbed off and hosed down along with their vehicles, the runoff is incredibly toxic. So, and I don't imagine that in the heat of battles, the soldiers are particularly environmentally aware or concerned, are they? I mean, so
that's true, especially if it's mustard. Mustard, it's not miscible with water, and it stays active as it's washed off, so you really have to worry about that. With sarin, it's a little different because it hydrolyzes. In other words, it gets deactivated by water over a period of time. And again, it also depends on what the coalition forces use as far as chemicals. If they have very effective chemicals that can decontaminate, for example, mustard, that also would make it less of a problem.
Mm-hmm. So there are chemical antidotes to mustard. And do they have them for sarin?
Yes. Well, like I said, with sarin, water works pretty well just as by itself. If you add just a little bit of chlorine or a little bit of bleach-like substance, then the sarin is gone pretty quickly. But you still have to worry about it in the short term, but after a few hours, it's pretty well decontaminated.
And then, but the VX is the bad one, right? That's a consistency of vegetable oil.
Yes, it's a bad one, but that's the one that they have the least of, and I sometimes worry if they have any that's used for.
But they declared 3.9 tons.
3.9 tons at the yes, exactly. 3.9 tons sounds like a lot, but in under battlefield conditions, you would use a ton in just to take one hill. So they would have to be pretty careful on how they apportion the use of the X if they have any.
So, since you're an expert on chemical weapons, Ray Zelinsky, I mean, it seems to me that in terms of warfare, they may not be that effective as a weapon, but they just slow things down. They cause logistical nightmares. Is that their purpose?
I think so. All of this, the effectiveness also has to do with what kind of panic reaction that they elicit among the people that are affected. So if the coalition forces are well trained, so they don't panic out, they put on their suits in order, and then they work through the contaminated area and also in, you know, with some efficiency, then their chemical weapons are not going to be very effective. But if everybody starts panicking out, and it's something you should never underestimate with either chemical or biological weapons, is their panic generating effects. The people that are exposed to these kind of weapons, they can't see it, they can't smell it, and it's easy to imagine that you are under attack if you feel anything at all unusual. And if you start panicking out, then the enemy has really accomplished his purpose.
But I just imagine if you are an American soldier or a coalition soldier who's been exposed to a chemical weapon and you're inside your suit and you're out in the middle of the desert waiting for a decontamination truck to arrive, not a very comforting prospect.
No. Again, most likely that they're going to have mustard. Mustard no. is the one that they had by far the most of, the one that they had the most experience with, and it would be used for area denial. And the effects of mustard is not immediate. It takes, depending on the concentration, of course, all the stuff you get exposed to. But if you have, for example, a mask on even, the main thing is that the initial effects of mustard is to affect your eyes, so they close up. They start tearing, and then they start swelling, and you can't see. And that's where you saw these photos from World War One, where you have a bunch of soldiers, one leading another one, and they're all blindfolded. Right. I mean, that's what mustard brought up. But it doesn't kill in 2 or 3 or 4 hours. It causes more like burns. So there's more time with mustard. The second agent that they have is sarin. Now, that is very quick acting if you breathe it in. If you have masks, that defends very well against sarin. You don't need full suits for that because, like I said, it doesn't absorb through the skin. So it's not as bad, I think, as some observers have imagined that it could be.
Well, Raymond, I thank you very much for joining us and giving us an idea of what may be facing the coalition forces in the
pleasure,
Iraq.
Yeah, and it really has to do with training. If the coalition forces are well trained to meet the exigencies of a chemical or biological attack, then they're going to handle it well. If they're not, then they might start panicking out, and that would really cause problems.
But I think for the people in the audience, I imagine all of them would feel that under those circumstances, they would panic. I mean, it takes a fairly steady nerve to endure that kind of situation.
Well, when I was in the Army, we went through training. We had to go into these little huts and be exposed to tear gas. It was not a pleasant experience. But if you do it once, twice, three times, you know pretty well how to put on suits and masks very quickly, and you learn.
I thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you, Ian.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Hello again, I'm Ian Masters. I'm just speaking there with Raymond Zelinskitz, who is the director of the Chemical and Biological Weapons Non-Proliferation Program at the Monterey Institute, and he's a former weapons inspector with UNSCOM, and he was in Iraq in the early 1990s. I'm now speaking with Bruce Lincoln, who is a professor of the history of religion at University of Chicago and the author of a new book, Holy Terrors, Thinking About Religion After 9/11. And Bruce, it seems that President Bush, I mean, he could argue that he has a sort of faith-based foreign policy in the sense that he is a man of resolute convictions, and he's talked about good and evil in particularly in relation to Saddam Hussein. And just on Friday at his press conference, he basically didn't answer any questions. He just kept repeating the same thing, that Saddam Hussein is evil, that war may be necessary to bring about regime change. How much? I've noticed that in the last few months, there's been more and more theological language creeping into his statements and into the his address to the joint session recently as well of Congress. I know that his chief speechwriter is also a born-again Christian, along with the president. The head of the Senate, Bill Frist, is a born-again Christian, and the de facto head of the House, Tom DeLay, also is. Do we have a born-again government?
Well, we certainly have a born-again rhetoric. They're very much trying to make this the front line of their advocacy for the war that they've been planning. And they've reduced it, I think, to a very simplistic dualism. As you suggest, there's a plot of a resolute man of faith on the one hand and a brutal dictator who's virtually evil incarnate and satanically inspired on the other hand. I think it's a plot that draws equally on biblical apocalypticism and Hollywood Westerns. And this has substituted for any attempt to really justify or argue their case.
Well, I believe that this sort of cottage industry that exists on Christian television, with the Armageddon industry, where they continually shake down people for money, talking about the end of the world and how those that give money, presumably, will be the righteous and will be saved. But over the years, because they've been flogging this stuff forever, it seems that the target of the Antichrist and the evil one has changed. It used to be the Soviet Union.
That's right. And with the end of the Cold War, they've had to adapt that script to a different situation. They've done that with a certain degree of ingenuity, and I'm not sure that it's selling as well as it once did, but it's selling much better than it should.
Well, I guess, Saddam Hussein is certainly a poster boy for evil, albeit, is pretty much a run-of-the-mill thug, except that he may have weapons of mass destruction. But, Brezhnev was just this sort of tired, they called it the period of stagnation. I mean, every day they'd give him another medal. It got to the point where he could barely stand up with all those medals, but I see how Saddam would improve the image of the Antichrist, but I thought the Antichrist was supposed to be a kind of wolf in sheep's clothing.
Well, there are various ways he can be depicted. I would make two points here. One is that they are able to produce such figures in their discourse, and they're very well rehearsed at it. They did it with Noriega, they did it with Gaddafi, they did it with the Ayatollah Khomeini. They really, are quite adept at making these figures out to be terrifying and simplistic as necessary. The second point I would make is that Saddam Hussein really is no worse than lots of dictators that U.S. policy has been very comfortable with. And indeed, U.S. policy was very comfortable with him. He was their instrument and their agent against the Ayatollah Khomeini during the Iran-Iraq War of 1980 to 1988. The same sorts of things that are now being used to describe him as a hideous terror were extremely useful and actively backed by American foreign policy in an earlier period.
Let me again remind the audience, if I may, I'm speaking with Bruce Lincoln, who's a professor of the history of religion at the University of Chicago and the author of a new book, Holy Terrors, Thinking About Religion After 9/11. And it seems, Bruce Lincoln, that the president, Bush, has, I think he's sort of tipped his hand more about religiosity, hasn't he? I mean, isn't there a kind of code that born-agains understand? I mean, he used it in his campaign, but he did get a question at the press conference on Friday about his personal faith, and I think he used the phrase that the thing that affected him mostly was the prayers of others, and the prayers lifted him up, and it just felt like a kind of code word to the faithful.
Yes, and he's cultivated the ability to do that. His relations to the evangelical religious right have always been strong. It's a core constituency that he's relied on since the beginning of his career. And previously, he has been very circumspect in addressing them. He does it through a deeply coded language that makes use of biblical allusion that sector of the population is very attuned to, and they, you know, are deeply gratified when he alludes to, you know, certain kinds of biblical verses in passing. But for much of the public, that can go by unnoticed, and this is exactly as the president's handlers want it. In his recent addresses, however, he's been much stronger, much more open in stressing the religious dimensions of his person and his faith and his policy. And I think in part that's because the rest of his attempt to sell this war is failing so badly.
What do you know, Bruce Lincoln, about his original born-again epiphany? It's attributed to Billy Graham.
Well, he has always credited Billy Graham as, and he's very, again, he's very careful. This is either he or his speech work writers are subtle in their use of language. He says Billy Graham, quote, planted a mustard seed in my heart, and in ways he's drawing on the Gospels there and parables that are recounted there. But he's also acknowledging that this was a very small moment, that the mustard seed is the tiniest of seeds, and that his encounter with Graham was rather small and passing, and that other people were much more influential, people he had had business dealings with and gone to college with and involved him in biblical study groups and ultimately got him to stop drinking as heavily as he had. And Graham played a supporting role, a minor role, in, you know, his religious transformation, but always gets the lion's share of the credit because he's the best known figure and the most useful for trumping up support.
So when did this conversion happen, and how long did it take?
Oh, you've got me. I'm not certain. In the period before he ran for governor, he had had a fairly unsuccessful flirtation with public office. His marriage was in a shambles, and I don't know the exact dates.
Mm-hmm.
I can probably find it here for you. Yeah.
Well, it's not that important, but I understand that there was a second epiphany at 9/11, where his presidency was essentially, ironically, sort of salvaged by this crazy Bin Laden, because he was pretty much going nowhere as a president. He'd lost the Senate, and he was sort of basically spent most of his time reading to preschoolers. And indeed, he was reading to preschoolers when 9/11 happened. But I'm told, and I think there's some of it in that new book by the called The Right Man, by the speechwriter who came up with the axis of evil phrase.
Michael Gerson.
No, he's the top speechwriter, and he is a born again. But the other fellow is Jewish. I can't remember his name now. David Fromm.
Oh, that's right.
Yeah. So that, I mean, how much do you know about the second epiphany, that this sort of gave him a focus, both for his presidency and for this kind of religious conviction of good fighting evil?
Well, he takes it as a calling, that he feels he has a mission, and that he has moral clarity and a religious calling to pursue certain kinds of policies. And certainly it was a presidency that was wandering, and a presidency that lacked legitimacy, that the circumstances of his election, you know, made it very dubious. And, you know, the events of 9/11 galvanized the nation behind him, gave him an extreme drama to draw on. And I do think he's taken it in religious terms, although I have not seen him publicly acknowledge that. The sense of calling, you know, seems to inform much of his rhetoric.
But, you know, clearly one cannot criticize people's personal faith. I mean, that was the among the many stupidities of the Marxists was that they forbade or tried to eradicate religion. And you can see what happened when the Soviets collapsed in Russia. It just came out of, it never went away in spite of Stalin demolishing the cathedrals. That's not the issue. My issue is that if you watch religious television, it's almost wall-to-wall Armageddon, and that's what they seem to be selling all the time. And it's all based upon bizarre interpretations of the Book of Revelation, which is in itself kind of a bizarre text, and the Eastern Orthodox Church doesn't even include it in their Bible. You get the feeling that these people are irresponsible hucksters who are completely, it's a form of madness. You know, the idea that the our planet is a merely transient thing. It's there to be, you can trash it if you like, because we're all going to die. Nobody should be president of the United States who has his finger on the nuclear button that even entertains this notion in the slightest way.
Well, I could go
it's
on.
It's a conflict of interest.
Television.
But it's a fundamental conflict of interest. That's what I'm saying. This is irresponsible religiosity.
Let me stick to the president. The First Amendment is really beautifully crafted. It has two clauses that speak to religion. One is the so-called free exercise clause, and that says every citizen has the right to the free exercise of his or her own faith. And George Bush is a citizen like anyone else, is free to believe anything he bloody well likes. The other clause is the Establishment Clause, and that says the government cannot take action that would have the effect of establishing any given religious position at the expense of others. And insofar as he's president and not just a citizen, he has no right to impose his beliefs on any policy act whatsoever. Now, he can take policy decisions, but they can't be based on some form of religiosity. They have to be rational, they have to be argued, they have to be subject to human scrutiny, they have to be justified in clear and persuasive terms. They can't grow out of his conviction that the world is coming to the end, or that God has tapped him on the shoulder, or that we are in the last days as good as struggling against evil, or the second coming is upon us, or anything. However minimally religious it might be, it should not feed into policy. And that's, you know, I think, the grave danger here.
Well, this phenomenon, though, of the born-again juggernaut, it's I always see it, from again, watching it on television, it seems to be a front for right-wing politics. I mean, it's hard to pass out the right-wing politics from the religiosity. And it's clearly a very, very solid constituency. It's kind of the born agains are the ones that lick the envelopes and get the votes out. Just as on the Democratic side, the union organizers get the votes out. So they're a core constituency. They're a valuable constituency to the Republicans. But the real point is that it's a growing constituency.
Yes, I think. You know, this is a constituency that after the embarrassment of the Scopes trial in the 1920s, essentially abandoned politics, you know, to devote themselves to prayer and faith and waiting for the last days. In the 1970s, they reconsidered that position and decided to enter the political arena again, and they've done so with tremendous effects, you know, first in support of Reagan campaign, and now, you know, even more energetically, I think, in support of Bush. And it's a constituency that the Republican Party has seized on with great enthusiasm, and I think it has many advantages to them. It's large, it's been underserved, and it's grateful for the attention that it gets. It is accustomed to tithing and devoting its energies and its money to the causes it embraces. It's also an extremely loyal constituency, and it's a constituency with a great capacity for faith and belief and trust in those it regards as dependable. And Bush has courted it assiduously, and it's repaid his attention very handsomely.
And this is a constituency that never quite trusted Bush Sr.
That's right. He was much too East Coast. He was much too much old money and traditional elites. He was, he wore his education on his sleeve, and he was uncomfortable with the kinds of enthusiasms that are essential for that constituency. Young Bush is much more attuned to that and comfortable with it.
Well, I think it's pretty clear that he actually is born again. I mean, I don't think this is a ruse, is it?
No, I think he's sincere. I think his life story is as he presents it, and I think his beliefs are largely as he presents them. But I think others, his speechwriters, his handlers, other powerful members of the administration, I'm thinking of Dick Cheney, Donald Rumsfeld, Paul Wolfowitz, those people, I think make excellent use of the president's beliefs to sell policies that they have a very, very hard time selling on any other grounds.
But again, Bruce Lincoln, this is a growing phenomenon, and particularly this born-again evangelical movement is incredibly powerful in Central and South America and in Africa. Now, I understand in the Third World, where there's a lot of poverty, and particularly in Central and South America, where the Catholics have dominated, one of the appeals is that the Catholics have always not indulged, but they certainly have condoned some amount of drinking. But I understand that the born again people, one of the first things they do is get people sober. And that is, of course, for a wife with 10 children, whose husband blows the paycheck on booze, that's helpful.
Sure, sure. And I think they have marketed themselves very much as a gospel of success. The investment of faith in the style of Christianity that they advocate is to be rewarded with material well-being as well as, post-mortem rewards, and this is very attractive to peasants and third people struggling in the Third World, and so they have expanded rapidly in recent years.
But so how do you explain the phenomenon here in the United States, the growing phenomenon?
Oh, my. I think it's regional in some measure. It's well-rooted in the South, the Midwest, rural areas. I think it speaks to those who are less well-educated, less successful financially, resentful of what they take to be changes that are disadvantageous to them. I think it also has been very successful in defense of what they represent as family values, that those whose sexual morality, sense of family loyalty, have been assaulted by changes in dominant values, and particularly those that are put in the foreground by mass media, see in these churches defenders of what they take to be right and decent and stability against chaos. I think they speak to scared people and
right.
resentful people, and I think they do so with a certain degree of fervor and energy that's gratifying. They've also mastered such things as cable television, mass mailing, talk radio, a host of very media savvy and technology savvy methods of reaching people and providing comfort and soliciting funds and feeding those funds back into their groups.
But I understand that also it's your fear that your children are going to be lost to this materialistic and prurient society. And curiously, the other day I heard a sermon from this radical imam in London who recruited the shoe bomber, Richard Reed, mm-hmm. and the guy Zacharias, the so-called 20th hijacker. And it was identical to much of what Falwell and Robinson have been saying. They railed against homosexuality and permissiveness and abortion. And so this is one of my doubts about the Bush war on terror, is that I don't know how you can fight religious fascists and theocrats abroad if you're in bed with them at home.
It is an irony. I think one of the great things religion does is stabilize established values, that if values are couched in a non-religious language, then they're up for debate and they're up for change. They're just human choices and preferences, and if they stop making sense, you conduct your life in a different way. When values are established or accepted as religious values, then they're given more than human status, and it's much harder to change them and much easier to cling to them, and I think this is one of the great securities that whatever form of so-called fundamentalist religion offers. And it's one of the things that makes it very attractive, particularly to those who are feeling embattled and nervous.
Well, just in closing then, Bruce Lincoln, where are the mainstream religion? I mean, if this tide is growing of religious fundamentalism around the world and here at home, why can't the mainstream people recapture the Bible? After all, fundamentalists believe in the Bible fundamentally. The Bible is a very compassionate document. Jesus didn't carry an assault rifle. He didn't hate homosexuals. He didn't fly around in a Learjet shaking people down for money on television. None of the experience of Jesus has anything to do with what these people are propagating.
You know, I don't agree with you on that. I think the Bible is a very varied and mixed document, and people can find in it what they want. Regardless of your position on a left-to-right spectrum or most any other variable, there are verses in the Bible that either transparently speak your purposes or with a little ingenuity and interpretation can be made to speak your purposes. And I think it's available to anyone who wants to make use of it.
I thank you very much for joining us in Los Angeles, Bruce Lincoln.
Thank you, Ian.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Bruce Lincoln, who is a professor of the history of religion at the University of Chicago and the author of a book, Holy Terrors, Thinking About Religion After 9/11. Hello again, I'm Ian Masters. I'm joined in the studio by John Sackrett Young, who is the consulting producer on a film that will be on FX channel, The Pentagon Papers. He also is the co-creator of China Beach, a long-running television series. He wrote the movie Romero, about Archbishop Romero, who was murdered by right-wing death squads in El Salvador. And thanks to A Grateful Nation, that recent movie about the so-called Desert Gulf War Syndrome, which is sort of echoes of our first guest, and again tonight's movie, The Pentagon Papers, and we're also hoping to talk to somebody that was at the Rand Corporation at the time where the movie takes place. There's these wonderful scenes in the movie of the backdrop of the ocean and the palm trees. It's amazing to think that people in the beautiful Californian sunshine are planning the deaths of thousands and thousands of people and the possible deaths of millions through a nuclear war.
Well, it's kind of wild and woolly to think about all these brains kind of hanging out in Santa Monica and eating at Shea Jay and jumping around on the beach. In a time period of ferment, and of course the irony is the film was shot in Toronto. Welcome to the world of 2003 television. And so when you're looking at the palm trees and the beach out the window, that of course is
well, you shouldn't
CGI.
You shouldn't give that away. But I thought though the thing that that I found powerful about the movie, and James Spader plays Ellsberg. But what I thought was powerful about the movie was the scenes on campuses where Ellsberg is being converted from a hawk to a dove, and there's a young kid at, I think it was at Swarthmore or somewhere, where he's sort of more or less saying, you know, I'm about to fast track into the elite, I'm a Harvard grad and all that stuff, but I'm going to go to jail because of my principles, you know.
Randy Keeler was his name, and he was very instrumental in Ellsberg's transformation, and they're still close, as far as I know, the two of them.
Mm-hmm. But did you? I mean, I got a bit of a frisson from that because of what's happening now. That you know, you have these demonstrations now preceding a war that hasn't even begun. That's an unusual phenomenon in itself. Whereas the Vietnam War started in what, 1963, and the demonstrations didn't get up and running until about 1968.
Well, the Vietnam War is one of those you can question. We were there. There's a amazing letter from Zachary Taylor in the 1840s to the kind of emperor of Vietnam. It wasn't called Vietnam then, kind of laying out the word that America would let him have it if, again, they kind of interrupted us or our navy. So it, in a way, it wasn't that much of a stretch to go to the Gulf of Tonkin in 1964, when this kind of curious incident happened that, or may have not happened, that led us to have the Gulf of Tonkin Resolution, which gave Lyndon Johnson the freedom to go into Vietnam.
Well, let me just read it from a letter that just came out recently. This is addressed to the Secretary of State, Colin Powell, from a diplomat, John Brady Keesling, who just resigned from his post in Greece. The sacrifice of global interest to domestic politics and to bureaucratic self-interest is nothing new, and it is certainly not a unique American problem. Still, we have not seen such systematic distortion of intelligence, such systematic manipulation of American opinion since the war in Vietnam. The September 11th tragedy left us stronger than before, rallying around us the very international coalition to cooperate for the first time in a systematic way against the threat of terrorism. But rather than take credit for those successes and build on them, this administration has chosen to make terrorism a domestic political tool, enlisting a scattered and largely defeated Al-Qaeda as its bureaucratic ally.
Well, you know, there's several stories that we could have told about the Pentagon Papers. Obviously, there was the freedom of press issue that went to the Supreme Court. But I think the story, because movies tend to focus on a character and a plot, and you kind of try and thread or knit the issues around that, it was our decision to say, hey, what is the government saying? And it's that credibility gap, to use the quote of the time, that was so instrumental in transforming Ellsberg. And if you lie to the American people, that's what goaded him finally to say, let's get these papers out there.
Let me bring on Conrad Kellen, who is was a senior analyst at the RAND Corporation at the time of when the Pentagon Papers were purloined, and he was also secretary to Thomas Mann. And Conrad, you were circulating a petition, or involved in the circulation of a petition at RAND against the Vietnam War at the very time this was all going on. So I think the audience would be surprised to know that there was actually an anti-war movement within the RAND Corporation itself.
Yes, we were five people who pointed out in very sober and calm language that the war was needlessly taking lives, both of ours and of the so-called enemy, and that it should be terminated as soon as possible without conditions.
Now, did the whole Ellsberg explosion with the Pentagon Papers and in the movie it makes it clear that Harry Rohn was sort of hung out to dry. Was everybody surprised that this happened under their noses?
Well, it was, yes. People were surprised. People had not expected that Ellsberg would go public with his information and his opinions. But once he did, I, at least for one, was very pleased that he had done so, because I thought that it was completely legitimate what he had done openly. After all, he didn't do it secretly.
Well, but I think the whole point is made in the movie is that he broke the law.
Yes, it was against the law, but the law is all powerful only in dictatorships. There are certain points where the law has to bend to the realities of situations. Otherwise, you don't have a democracy, I think. Anyhow, Ellsberg thinks so too, and therefore, I think his opinions and his release of the papers was completely not just useful in ending the war, but it was legitimate.
But
one thing about Daniel Ellsberg is interesting. In a way, the story has resonance or comparison to A Man for All Seasons and Thomas More, except, and Conrad can probably speak to this if he wishes, Daniel Ellsberg is not a simple man. He's
right.
Complex and has lots of warts.
Well, let me just say here that he was willing also to go to jail. It was just by an accident that he didn't go to jail.
And that's one of the most interesting things, in a way, is that not only does this turn out to be about the Vietnam War, it turned out, in a sense, what Ellsberg did had even more impact on bringing down a president. That Ellsberg's actions and the subsequent actions of Richard Nixon and the Plumbers led almost directly to the downfall, the bringing down of the first United States president.
Well, I guess Ellsberg was lucky we had a crazy president.
Yeah, right. He was
a criminal president.
But he was, and this is not a fake. I mean, he was literally and absolutely ready to go to war, go to jail for releasing the papers.
Now, Conrad, did you witness Ellsberg's conversion from a hawk to a dove?
I saw it only after he came back from Vietnam, yes. I mean, I knew that in Vietnam he had changed his mind from hawk to dove.
I think, when he came back,
yes.
I don't think he was all the way across yet. In a sense, he was, I think, it then became torn and was unsure.
But people who changed from hawk to dove had a long way to go, because the conflicts were very great between them. And those who did make the journey from war to peace did not so in one day, you know.
Absolutely.
We've run out of time, gentlemen. I'm really sorry that we didn't run longer. And I thank you, Conrad Kellen. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I thank the engineer, Mark Maxwell. Thanks for joining us. Bye.